Something Pongs. All this and more coming up on This Week in Retro.
High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
The entire history of RPGs.
Have you played Atari today?
And Hall of Fame.
All these stories and a whole lot more coming up on today's show.
Up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.
Hello, Dave. Another week, another This Week in Retro. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, very well indeed.
Are you tired from yesterday?
You're talking about the big workshop clear out at the mill.
Yeah.
No, because technically I wasn't supposed to be there. I was down in Dorset seeing family, but I did get back earlier than expected and just got to put a couple of hours in, but nowhere near as much effort and work as everyone else that was there. They did a huge job, took everything out of the workshop. So this is the detached building that's next to the arcade and helps to service the arcade. That's what it's there for. Took everything out, built new racking, tidied it up, sorted out the rubbish from the stuff that should be kept, while Richard was building new bars and dividers in the reception of the arcade. The purpose of that is so that we can get more arcade machines in the arcade archive so that customers have got a lot more to play and enjoy in that separate room. Initially, that room is going to be the broken arcades, so there'll be talking points about what we're going to work on next, and then hopefully in time they will become working arcades and the arcade will grow bigger and people will have all the more reason, again, to come and visit the arcade archive. So that's what we've been up to. In answer to your question, no, not as tired as everyone else is, I'm sure. Are you tired, Dave?
I'm always tired. I'm always tired. That's what being grown up is.
It is, yeah. The managing tiredness, that is.
Yeah.
They don't prepare you for that at school. I've also been thinking of rare items, Dave, this week, because I've got a couple of small cabinets, small glass light-up cabinets coming for the museum tomorrow. They arrive. And I've been thinking about what to put in them.
Now, Doom.
One of them will be dedicated
to Guiana Sisters.
Rare examples of games. So things like that. And then I don't know what to do with the other one, whether it's first editions of magazines or hardware or what. I don't know yet.
Of magazines sounds good. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm. That's a good idea.
Well, it does mean I then need to source that Amiga format.
Don't talk about that. Does the auction finish before this goes out?
There is another auction has come up for another Amiga format issue one. It will have ended by the time the show goes out.
Ah, that's fine. Then we can talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, the last one went for £97 and had a tear on the front. This particular one is sealed as new with the disc. Yeah. And its starting price is £99. So
is it worth the £2?
Goodness knows. It's not a buy it now, it's a bid. So goodness knows how much this is going to end up at. It doesn't have to be sealed, the one I get.
You can unseal it, surely. They don't belong to me. They have to be sealed.
If it's sealed, it must have been a subscriber edition that was posted, surely. Because I don't remember them being sealed in the shops.
No, I remember the cover discs being cut off and you getting it when you bought the magazine.
Oh, I didn't live in a rough area, Dave. The cover discs were on my magazines.
You see, I didn't live in a village. but I'm not entirely... I do remember magazines in plastic wrappers, but maybe that's not computer magazines I'm thinking about.
Yeah. Magazines in brown paper bags.
No, I joking aside, I do remember magazines. Things that had like Retro Gamer this month, for example, came with an extra smaller magazine. I've not even looked at it, I don't even know what it is yet, but it came with that, and that's how I think they packaged them. They put them in plastic wrappers so you get it all together. So it's not inconceivable.
Yeah, there were special editions. There were ones with like foil wrappers. There were all sorts of special things. But I did buy these copies of Amiga format back in the day. So in my memory, they weren't. The whole magazine wasn't sealed.
Should also say that Amiga format Edition 1 kind of wasn't Edition 1 because it came from a magazine ST and Amiga format that, as the market got bigger for like 16 bits, it split into two. So presumably there were some people who were subscribing to ST Amiga format and they would be told, you'll need to choose which one you want now.
Choose your own adventure.
There could be, choose your own adventure, what next books? It could be that someone chose to go the Amiga format route, and that's why they got the subscriber one, because you wouldn't think there'd be that many subscriber editions for an issue one normally.
Well, maybe someone remembers. Maybe I falsely remember. Maybe my news agent just happened to cut the packets open and put the magazines in out the bag. So if you've got any different memories,
I don't know.
Let us know. As always, the show is based around your comments and your stories at reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. So give us some feedback there. Do please subscribe if you're not already subscribed to us on your podcast. What do you call it? Podcatcher of choice.
That's a good word, isn't it?
Yeah, or subscribe on YouTube. Now, let's get straight into the first story, Dave.
No, let's not.
Oh, come on, Dave.
These things. Remember, Neil, I said I was going to mention them?
Oh, sorry. Dave's got some toys. Tell us about your toys, Dave.
One of our listeners, our viewers, Chris, has been in Japan. Chris McKay, and he brought me a couple of presents back. These little Lego-inspired little dinosaurs. So I'm going to build those up, and I'll show you them next week once they're all built up. So thank you very much, Chris. It was very kind of you. I do like dinosaurs. I like little things like this.
That is nice, and that will take you a week to build, won't it, Dave?
But it would not take anyone else all week to build, but I'll do it properly, I'm sure, Neil. That's why it'll take me longer.
Okay. Are you ready?
We can start now.
Okay. Okay, press the button, Duncan, or whatever you do.
A few weeks ago, I talked about a YouTube rabbit hole with a channel called Never Knows Best. He helped me to understand how I really feel about modern RPGs, and by modern, I mean anything in the last 20 years. So things like Mass Effect, Dragon Age, Knights of the Old Republic. He helped me to understand why these games are great and why I like them, but also why I missed lots of what used to be in the genre. He also introduced me to a term CRPG, which doesn't mean what I thought it did, and he told me about modern ones, which I mean to play, but I didn't because I fell into the hole of playing Fallout 4 and Survival. Now, Happy Coding has submitted a video, one I was going to watch anyway because it comes from Never Knows Best, so it's on my feed anyway, and it's a long one. It's 2 hours and 43 minutes long. Never takes his time, but he doesn't ramble, which is what we try to do in this podcast to a greater or lesser level of success. He starts banging the money by talking about how D&D came from wargaming to become the first big tabletop RPG, and how it went on to computers with computer RPG genre, which I used to think what CRPG was.
So I guess you mean exactly the same place I'm coming from when I think about this, which is that RPG was an RPG. It was in the context of a computer game. I didn't use the word CRPG, did you?
Yeah, so CRPG was how, I mean, you had an RPG, which was what you played with Dungeons & Dragons with your friends around a table, and a CRPG was when you played it on your computer and the Bard's Tale or Wizardry or something like that.
But so did you use that word CRPG back in the day? You did? Because you had a wider context of RPGs then compared to me, who didn't know anyone that did tabletop gaming, so I didn't need to differentiate.
I think I saw the word used more often in perhaps in Dragon magazine, which was a magazine for tabletop RPG, and they were talking about computer ones.
Right.
But CRPG seems to have changed, and while I don't think anyone's changing the first word of it, when they say CRPG, they don't mean things like Skyrim or Fallout. They mean games that go back to the roots of the genre in the 80s and 90s. What happened was you had games tending towards the console route, towards the action role-playing game route, to the point where you had, coming in from both directions, you had games like BioWare and Bethesda games, so games like Dragon Age and Mass Effect and Fallout and The Elder Scrolls, tending towards action-based, and you had games on the other side like Fallout and Assassin's Creed and so on, adding RPG elements and ending up fairly close to each other in the same space. And that's what RPGs became. And then CRPGs are coming back now. These are the crowd-funded games that came out in the last decade, things like Pathfinder, Kingmaker, Disco Elysium, games like that, which are more true to the original RPG roots. And they're getting called CRPGs to differentiate them between what the RPG genre is now.
I have seen some people define the C as classic rather than computer.
Yes. So you could think of it as classic RPGs. And I don't think there's anything wrong with thinking that way, other than people correctly say, well, actually, it's computer RPGs. Mm. And they're not wrong to say it. Going back to the video, I like that he picked up on something that was important that a lot of people overlook. Early RPGs and CRPGs were heavily based in Tolkien's work, so Lord of the Rings, Middle-earth, etc. And something weird happened where D&D kind of took over that genre so much that everything then became D&D inspired rather than Tolkien inspired. And he correctly identifies one of the most important things about RPGs, which is world building. That's super important to me and to you, I think, as well, Neil, because you loved exploring Ultima, for example, for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I won't talk you through the whole doco. I will say that it's excellent. I will also say I'm surprised how good it is, because I know he's younger than us, and I know from his previous videos that he wasn't playing Wizardry or The Bard's Tale in the 80s, and he came to the genre later, but he has done his research, and he's learned enough to talk about it properly.
He's a historian, Dave, and there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Yes. Some people will talk about things where they don't know, and you can tell, but he's not in that category. He does mention a book that helped him, Dungeons and Desktops, which I have read. That. Yeah, okay. It's a good book. And he also mentioned another book, which I haven't read, but I bought from you, Neil.
I know what that is.
Yeah, the CRPG book.
From Bitmap Books, yes.
Yeah. I haven't read it yet. I've still got that to look forward to. But he says that's good as well for different reasons.
That's not necessarily one that you would read from start to finish. You can, dip into whatever games you want to read about and dip in and out of that particular book, yeah.
Although I probably will read it from start to finish, and then later on I will dip in and out. But don't be put off by how long the video is. It is incredible. You can sit down, you watch a bit of it, and then stop and choose to watch the rest of it or not. You can learn about the earlier stuff that became. I mean, if you're our age, unless you learn about the earlier stuff, you probably wouldn't know it. But it's done in a chronological but not strict order, split into sort of eras, trying to get into decades. It's really good, though. But I thought I'd drift away from that particular video and ask you, Neil, what's your history of RPGs? I'll give you mine afterwards, but what's yours?
Okay. I was going to mention the Bitmap books, the CRPG book, because I'm reading that. I haven't watched this video yet because I need to find the time to sit down for 3 hours. Is it the kind of video that I could watch in chunks and enjoy as easily?
Yeah. Watch 20 minutes, half an hour, and see how you feel.
Yeah, so I think I'll probably dip in and out of the video while I'm dipping in and out of this book, and it'll just be nice to immerse myself in all this history and get all of these different opinions from different places. You've been talking about action RPGs or action CRPGs and CRPGs. To me, there's a really fine balance between the action and the RPG element to get it just right. Some games don't get it right for me. I probably personally lean just slightly more towards the action than the hardcore CRPG. Which is probably why I like, for example, in Ultima 7, ding, there's an Ultima mention, Duncan, the real-time combat, whereas in Ultima 6, it was turn-based, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some people have a preference on that. Some people would say real-time is more too action-y for their RPG tastes. But where does it sit? Where does the line sit for you?
The problem with turn-based in, for example, the gold box games, the SSI gold box game, which are sitting behind me, is that it eventually becomes tedious, and you run into another group of goblins, There's no question how the fight's going to end, but you still need to go through all the steps of doing it. You would do this a lot in Ultima 4 and Ultima 5. So the problem with turn-based is it ends up being boring and tedious and a chore. So the action side of things can be great there, and that's what happened in Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2, for example. They were, underneath it all, they were strictly turn-based, but it was live action, so you could pause it when you wanted to, or if it was just a group of goblins, not pause it. And the balance was great there. But when it comes to other games that are more actiony based, things like Dungeon Siege, Diablo, or the is it FromSoft? Who's it makes the games that I'm thinking about that I haven't told you what it is? The Japanese one with the big swords.
Final Fantasy.
No. The really hard game. It's said it's an RPG, but it's really a how good are you with a console controller game. Dark Souls, that's it.
Oh, Dark Souls. Okay.
Yeah. That's too much actiony for me. Those are how good can you work your controller rather than the decisions you make.
Yeah.
So that's where Diablo and so on. Nah, I'm not so interested in that. Yeah.
And you almost strayed there into another important part of the conversation when it comes to these games, which is the word grind. You know, how much grind is there involved? And going from groups of goblins to goblins, it just turns into a grind, and that's where the fun is taken out of it. So it's such a difficult balance, and it's not a balance I think the designers ever truly have total control of. They're creating a world that they drop you in, and it's an ecosystem, and they set the parameters, and they all have to level themselves out. Really, there's too much for them to completely control that world.
I would say that for me, I need a story and I need world building in my RPG, and if anything, games are generally too long. There's generally too much combat in them, particularly in the middle section of the games. One of the games that's everyone says is great is Lands of Lore, which is a Westwood Studios game that they did after doing Eye of the Beholder. They took the Eye of the Beholder engine, they enhanced it, they didn't use the D&D franchise, they didn't license that, they made their own franchise. They hired Patrick Stewart to do the voice acting. And they made Lands of Lore, which is widely said to be a fantastic dungeon crawler style game. But if you watch a Let's Play of it, there's a huge section, the majority of the game after you go through the initial dungeons is a fairly boring chewing through lots and lots and lots of combat and going back through the same areas where the enemies are respawning and so on. That's not necessary. I don't want to do that these days. So there's too much grinding in them. Yeah. Fallout 4 that I've been playing recently has this legendary thing where some enemies will spawn as legendary, and they have a chance, they will always drop a legendary item, which is a chance to be something useful, or more often something not useful. And that's a mechanism that they've taken directly from MMOs. That's a mechanism they've taken from online RPGs, which are designed to keep you coming back and doing the same things. And I realized I was doing that with Fallout 4 and thinking, I don't want to do this. I don't want to play an MMO. I want to get through the game and through the story and finish with it rather than live in the world forever. So the grind is a perpetual thing that they have to find the right thing with. But other people like the grind.
Coming back to my own history, it's probably entirely predictable to you. It did start with Final Fantasy books. That was probably my introduction to fantasy worlds.
It started with Fighting Fantasy.
Sorry, not Final Fantasy, Fighting Fantasy, yes. The Choose Your Own Adventure books, yes. I didn't know any tabletop D&D groups. I'm sure there were plenty around. It was just as popular in my town as anywhere else. But I didn't get involved in any of them. So RPGs were a computer thing for me. On the computer, Ultima 6 was the game that absolutely hooked me in. I dabbled with things like Bard's Tale and Dungeon Master, but it was Ultima 6 that gave me that feeling of the living, breathing world experience, as opposed to I'm navigating a maze from skeleton to skeleton. That's what really lit the fire beneath me for these kind of games. Dave?
Yeah, when Never's doing this video, he talks about a world simulation. And he talks about Ultima 7 and so on being that type of world simulation. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then beyond Ultima, I played all sorts of games, probably leaning slightly towards the not action, but the slightly lighter weight, perhaps, mm-hmm. games like Shadowlands. I don't know if you ever played that one.
No.
Nice isometric game. That was on the Amiga. I was playing that one. I wouldn't describe them as light, but they had a good use of video game elements and leaning into that more than leaning super hard into the tabletop elements and the just overburdening you with stats and things like that. I found them more accessible. So I like these games. I wouldn't call myself as hardcore into these games as you are, Dave, the exception being Ultima, which I absolutely love those worlds. So that's my history. And then on to Ultima Online, which became an obsession for years, but that's going into MMOs, as you were talking about, and that has very different mechanics built around it. Morrowind, that took me into the 3D CRPGs after a couple of false starts with the horrible Ultima 9. And then I played Oblivion Inside Out. I think Oblivion was the first example of a CRPG that I saw my friend playing on an Xbox 360. And I thought, hang on a minute, you're getting just as good an experience, just as full and complete experience on a games console as I am on my home computer, on my PC. That was probably the first example I felt of that. And people will be shouting, oh, but we had things like Zelda and things like that. We had our own games. But yeah, Dave, you're jumping up and down.
Yeah, one of the things that never talks about in this video, he does put things in context with what else was going on. He talks about how the failure of the whole PC RPG thing, it all just died. And then new companies gathered, picked up the torch and ran on. Blizzard and BioWare and Bethesda picked up the torch from Interplay and Origin and... Oh, I nearly remembered all six names there. Interplay, Origin, and who? SSI. The three companies that failed, and then three new companies came out, and those three companies now are failing. BioWare, and Blizzard, and Bethesda have all had failures recently. It's almost like a mirror of what happened before. There's one other thing I won't spoil that I feel as if I'd be stealing his amazing insight at the end of the video, so I'll leave that till the end. But yes, the whole consolization is a big thing in RPGs, and what happened was the only really successful RPGs were the ones that came out on PC and console at the same time.
And then I guess the final point I'd make about my own history of role-playing games is that role-playing was something that I would say I did in a lot of non-CRPG games. You know, how can you not play Elite, for example, and fill that imagination gap with grandiose ideas that you're an actual space pirate on a mission or sailing the world in pirates? You know, I would role-play games that were not really role-playing games, and I'm sure you did too.
Yeah, and I don't see why you can't call them RPGs, because in Elite and in Pirates, you have stats. In Elite, it's whether you have beam lasers or military lasers in your front thing, whether you have fuel scoops or not. And in Pirates, it's how many men you've got, which ships you've got, and so on. So they are, I think you could define them as RPGs. I'm sure some people would argue, but I think you could define those as RPGs. For myself, and much the same as you, I started with RPGs, fascinated by the storytelling and the world building. I moved on from kids' sci-fi and fantasy books to choose your own adventure, and then quickly on to fighting fantasy. Fighting fantasy are novels like Choose Your Own Adventure, but they had stats and dice rolls. So they were as close to you as you could get to an RPG, but it's sort of almost being a computer RPG, because the book was doing the computer's role for you. You didn't need anyone else for it. With my CPC, they were thin on the ground. I did play text adventures, and then I played the odd RPG. The Bard's Tale is the one that I played most in the CPC. And by then I was reading imports of Dragon magazine. So Dragon magazine was published by the same people, TSR, that made D&D.
How did you get wind that Dragon magazine existed? Was that from pamphlets within the games that you were buying, or how?
No, this is that there was an RPG shop in my hometown for about a year before it closed, and they imported Dragon magazine. So once they started importing Dragon magazines, I happened to notice it was in W.H. Smith sometimes, so I'd buy it from W.H. Smith. So Dragon magazine was a it was by the people that made D&D, but it wasn't exclusive to D&D. And one of the things they had in it, one of the regular columns they had, was the role of computers. And they talked about games I couldn't play, because it was mainly American computers they were on. But they talked about Dungeon Master. And that's the first game that I read about extensively before I played. And it's the first game I got for my Atari ST. It was a revelation. It was such a good game. It had everything I wanted, mostly, although it was action-focused, but it wasn't too badly action-focused that it would have required on dexterity to succeed rather than decisions. On to Captive on the ST, which is a sci-fi thing. And by the time I finished the ST and moved on to the PC, I was pretty much only playing RPG strategy type games, Ultima 4 and 5 and 6. And then when I moved on to the PC, it was for Eye of the Beholder, Ultima 7, Ultima Underworld, amazing games. Having the hard disk made all the difference. And when the internet came around, I got into MUDs. So MUDs were multi-user dungeons, which were text adventures with RPGs built in online with other people. They started as, I believe they started as called Door Games and BBSs. Mm. I was never into BBSs.
You were a MUD wrestler.
Yes, I was chronically addicted to them for years while you were playing Ultima Online. And then games like Baldur's Gate came out while I was still playing MUDs. And then later, of course, things like Neverwinter Nights, Morrowind, and the BioWare games like Mass Effect and so on. I've never really played much tabletop. I tried in school, but I just couldn't. It was so much hassle to get people to play. Playing on a computer was the answer for me.
I can imagine myself really getting into it at some point when the clumsiness of VR gives way to just a very natural augmented reality experience, and you can sit down, look at a table, and play a computerized but traditional tabletop game through AR with friends remotely. I really, really want to get into that, but the day's not... I know you can do it, but I think the day when it's super easily accessible and enjoyable will come, and I want to take part in that.
I think to do it, you need to be setting aside like 3 or 4 hours for a session per week, and that's a big ask.
I want to look down on my virtual tabletop game and see like a mini Dave on a throne, yes, being dungeon master or whatever, and a little me and my friends walking around. You know, it's borderline video game, but you know what I mean. I want that tabletop gaming experience with the ease of access.
The whole point of the CRPGs is to have the computer do things like look after stats for you, remember things, to do dice rolls, to apply the rules and so on. So perhaps they can assist us that way. I'm not sure if I ever would. I'm not really into the kind of the amateur dramatic side of it, the Renaissance fairs thing, the acting and so on. Not really my cup of tea. So the computer side of it kind of suits me better. But as for what's next for me, I need to stop replaying Fallout and Elder Scroll games and Mass Effect and so on, and play new games. And I bought Pathfinder Kingmaker as a result of one of Niver's earlier videos and didn't get around to playing it. I need to move away from a comfort zone of replaying the same games I liked and play the games I didn't. And as the ghost of Chris would say, play more in 24.
Dave, if you wanted to play an RPG, you would need a computer. And computers are made of what?
Computers are made of PCBs.
They are made of PCBs. So it's great that our sponsor is PCBWay.com, a producer of PCBs.
Fantastic. PCBWay make more than PCBs, though. What else do they do, Neil?
Well, they do 3D printing. They do CNC milling. They do all sorts, Dave. They do all sorts. It's like a little RPG adventure in itself, just browsing PCBWay.com, isn't it?
That's right. They've got the shared projects as well. You can get them to assemble the PCBs. They can add the little bits on for you. The
components?
Yes, the components.
The components, yes.
I was thinking, what's the word that people call for the tiny little bits, the tiny little surface-mounted things that people don't want to do?
Oh.
Those bits. Yeah, they'll do that for you.
Yeah.
But thank you very much to PCBWay for sponsoring us. PCBWay.com for all of your PCB needs.
Thanks, PCBWay. I've decided to mash a couple of stories together today, Dave. Both are submitted by Lord Borak 316, so thank you for that. And both of them are Atari-related, the granddaddy, some might argue, of video games. The first story concerns us with old Atari and Al Alcorn. He was the chief engineer who famously created the Pong arcade at the request of Nolan Bushnell. That was the first commercial smash hit in the arcade world and was famously not at all inspired by seeing a Magnavox Odyssey at a previous expo. Not at all. That did not happen. Al Alcorn has decided to auction off some of his personal collection. And unsurprisingly, there are some real jewels in there. Really interesting pieces. Definitely pieces that I would like to see end up in a museum. But I think I can say with absolute confidence that these will end up well out of my price range and will end up, hopefully, I really hope, in a well-established, accessible museum and hopefully not squirreled away in a private collection. Items include Cosmos from 1980. Now, I don't know if you've heard of this, Dave. This was an unreleased tabletop game by Atari, although it looks to be pretty complete, the prototype that we're seeing. And on the face of it, it looks like any other tabletop game, like let's think of some Astro Wars or Caveman or something like that. Very similar in style. A grid of LEDs on for the screen and just a standard looking control panel. But here's where the difference lies. The idea was that you slipped a holographic overlay onto the screen for each game. Now we're talking about, do you remember those holographic cards, the types that you got in your cereal for, well, going back to D&D, there was a range of Dungeons and Dragons holographic cards.
Yes. Yeah. It's Panini football stickers, I remember Panini, having that.
Oh, you had this special edition holographic one.
Yeah, with the badges on them, yeah.
That was more like a holographic background, wasn't it, with the normal badge? Whereas I'm talking about the ones that had real depth. There would be like a dragon.
Oh, He-Man. I remember He-Man ones.
He-Man ones, yeah. And I think there were some kind of weird monstery ones. But yeah, Dungeons & Dragons is the one specifically I remember in my serial. It was that kind of thing. So you would put that onto the game. It would give the game a bit of depth in that weird kind of green tinge that everything had. But that sounds pretty cool to me. This was 1980, so I think that would have been cool.
Yeah, I heard about it from one of Reese's videos talking about obscure Atari stuff. He's told me about that. So it's not something I was aware of back in the day. It's only something I've heard of reasonably recently.
Yeah, and the gameplay would have been relatively simple based on the fact that it's just rows of LEDs. But I'm sure it would have been quite exciting in 1980. There's also an arcade machine up for auction called Space Race. Have you heard of this one, Dave?
Nope.
Right, okay, that's interesting. This was the 1973 follow-up to Pong in the arcades, and apparently their first machine, perhaps the first arcade machine to feature joysticks, although they only went up and down. There were two joysticks, it was a two-player game, and you had to navigate through an asteroid belt. Completely failed to capture the public's imagination in the same way that Pong did, but, you know.
Yeah, I can see why.
There. Yeah?
It's, yeah, it's...
You're watching it now.
I've clicked on a few images and you can see, tell from the image how it plays, and I don't know why. I mean, Pong's it's more depth than Pong, but I don't see the appeal in it. Yeah.
Well, that's there. That's up for auction. You won't be bidding on it from that comment, Dave, but it's there. And these things take us back to the roots of Atari products and the old guard before Trammell bought Atari computers. Time Warner represented Atari games from 1984 and everything changed, although we still did get some great Atari arcades after 1984. The other story that I want to talk about brings us bang up to date with new Atari plans in the arcade sphere. So we think of Atari arcades for the classics like Asteroids and Star Wars. They actually released games through to 1999, which I didn't realize they were doing it that late. So their final three games were called War Final Assault, Road Burners, and San Francisco Rush 2049. Now, the last one's the only one I've heard of. I've not played any of those.
Yeah, yeah. Same.
So, they went out with a whimper and not a bang, I would guess. But they are back. They are back now. They've got a series of arcades called Recharged. Let's just read the quote from the website here. It says, "The Recharged series has reintroduced some of Atari's most recognized and celebrated titles to new generations of players." That's said by Ethan Zubek, president of Atari. "We're excited to be working with a leader in the arcade space to bring these games to an even wider audience." Now, that leader that he's referring to is a company called Alan-1 Incorporated. That's a reference to a Tron character called Alan Bradley, Alan-1. Now, the Recharge series have been released elsewhere. I'll come on to that in a minute. It might be a stretch to call Alan 1 a leader in the arcade space, given that they have a product range of 1 on their website. That's an arcade named Avian Knights, which is also available on Steam. It's a four-player joust-like game with traditional arcade joysticks and buttons on the control panel. And to be honest, I'd give it a go. It looks like something I want to walk up to with my friends in a gauntlet style, shoulder to shoulder with four controls there to all play on.
I would say, though, it's not quite gauntlet style because it looks as if it's nasty. It's going to make you be angry because you... I noticed one of the things with it, if you get separated from your mount, you can track it down and get back on it, but your opponents can eat the egg, I think, and get powered up, so they can... It sounds more like Mario Kart levels of multiplayer fun rather than gauntlet cooperative stuff.
Yes, yeah. underneath it all, of course, it's going to be based on a regular PC or a modern console. It's got a big old widescreen, as expected. It's a modern arcade. So that's the hardware. The Atari Recharged range of games, they actually started back in 2020. They're also available on Steam, Switch, PlayStation, Xbox, all of the other online stores, and they include Berserk, Asteroid, Centipede, Gravatar, Missile Command, and all the other ones you'd expect with the Atari name on them. So what we're seeing here with this is the repackaging of this range of games in an arcade cabinet format for location-based entertainment. I don't think we even say arcades anymore. It's location-based entertainment because this will be placed in a location where a vendor thinks it will make money for them. An arcade to home remaster, back to the arcade port. That's kind of the way it's gone. Arcade, home, arcade again. Dave, would you put 10 pence in this, or would you save your 10 pence to put towards the auction?
I'd stick 10p in and presumably take it back out of the coin return and have to scan my phone for it with NFC, not NFT like you said last week, Neil.
Oh, did NFC. I say NFT?
You did. Neil fudging terms last week. or maybe it takes pound coins. It certainly won't be 10p. The arcade cabs look fine to me. There's something to do for a bit of fun when you're somewhere that has them. You'll be, I don't know, you'll go somewhere on holiday and you'll arrive there and you'll notice it and you'll say, oh, that'll be a bit of fun to play on, just like arcade cabs used to be. Avian Knights does look fun.
You could actually, Dave, you could use NFT to pay for it via NFC.
Shut up. Avian Knights does look fun. Avian Knights is actually 8 players.
Is it 8
so
players?
Yeah, you can get a 2-player or 4-player cab, but there must be some kind of link because it says up to 8 local players. Mm-hmm. So that does seem like a bit of knifing each other in the back fun.
A chaotic experience.
Yes.
In the same way that Super Off-Road or Super Sprint or Gauntlet, you know,
yeah,
with players. It does sound fun. But then I could just open Steam and install it now and play it.
But you wouldn't be somewhere spontaneously and playing on your Steam. You would be, you mentioned you're away visiting family. You might be visiting family, you go out for a meal and, I don't know, you go to a Harvester for a carvery meal and you see the machine and say, let's have a go on that. And you all have a go on it just spontaneously like that. That's what they're aiming for here.
Or just when we're hanging out with our gang on a Saturday in town like we do, Dave.
Gang, yes. Yeah. Do you have gang signs?
Oh, yeah, we just turn up on our BMXs. Like, where should we hang out today? maybe 40 years ago.
The Atari Recharged is official Atari modern indie style remakes of their old classics with extra stuff added. And if I'm going to be honest about them, what's special about these really? This has been going on for literally decades. People have been riffing on 70s and 80s Atari coin-op classics to make their own games. I bashed indie Asteroids game into Google and it came up with something more interesting than their Asteroids. It came up with something called Power of 10, which is out on Steam now with very positive reviews, and it's out on Switch by the time this episode comes out. It's an Asteroids-style roguelike game. So it's the Asteroids gameplay, but it's a roguelike procedurally generated thing. Not played it, but I just typed into Google just to prove a point. It doesn't have the Atari name on it. That's the only thing about this. So for these games to matter, the only thing they have is the Atari name. So the Atari name needs to be a name that says quality, not just a name that says, hey, remember the old arcades? Well, why not buy yet another lazy re-release of our old IP or a latest in a long line of system-on-a-chip emulation devices. So Atari have to get beyond what they have been for the past, I don't know, 20 years with their new ownership.
Slightly in their defense, and I'm thinking about the arcade sphere specifically, what is the incentive for them to actually go out there and make a brand new original game just for the arcades?
Well, I'm not saying they should.
Whether they should or not, the incentive just doesn't exist anymore to do that. Mm. It has to cater to the home market first and foremost, doesn't it?
Yeah, but all I'm saying is that these have to be, it has to be better than just yet another Steam cheap £1.39 on sale game that you buy and play for 10 minutes and forget about.
And that's where you lean into the being in the same physical space, that experience of trying to get eight people together.
Yeah. So they have taken big steps recently. Atari has done a lot of good things recently, but I'm not convinced yet. There's still more work for them to do, but I hope they do manage it. As for the auction, yeah, if it's an auction, it's going to be going to private collectors, and the best you could hope as a museum is that someone lends it to you.
Maybe one day. So yeah, two interesting stories. Thank you, Lord Borak, for submitting them. The Space Race one, that auction, I think, was around $11,000, something like that at the time of recording. It ends later in the week, so I'm sure there will be a flurry towards the end. Not something that you or I have any nostalgia for or real interest in that particular game, but it's clearly a piece of history. If you've got a collection and you've got Pong, then I'm sure you'd love to put that right next to it and work through the history of Atari video games. The history of video games, not just Atari. That's where it all goes back to. So I'm sure there will be a flurry of bids, and it'll be interesting to see where it ends up. In terms of the modern games, I don't know that there's anywhere where I will actually see this new Atari arcade pop up. Maybe a service station. Maybe it will pop up there.
I tried to give you a couple of examples. Somewhere on holiday, you go somewhere for a meal with a family and they've got them. The thing is, I don't think you would plan to go and play one of these unless it was in a professional capacity to make a video. But I don't think you would plan to go and play one of these. But if you happen to be somewhere where it was, give it a go. You would, and that's what they're designed for.
Yeah, absolutely. So, maybe we need our viewers to feedback. If you spot one of these in the wild, if you spot modern arcades in the wild, drop us a message over on our subreddit, because we love having these conversations and having our eyes opened, really, to how things are done beyond our limited little worlds and where we exist in. So let us know at reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. And I will try to remember to report back on how the auction ended next week.
So housekeeping, we have three new patrons. Thank you very much to Chris, to Stuart, and to Ben for signing up at the URL.
Oh, patreon.com/thisweekinretro. Thank you very much. And I recognize one of those as a patron of mine as well. So it's really nice to see Ben, in fact, extending his support to This Week in Retro as well. And Chris, I won't read out Chris's surname, but I love his full name.
Yeah, I wonder if it is his real name or if he picked it himself.
Oh, I wouldn't mess with him with the name.
There are
like
a few people that are blessed with a brilliant name like that. We noticed a new review. In fact, we noticed an old review that we hadn't noticed. But the new review says, best for retro. It's from FPGA Gamer on the Apple Podcast platform. He says, genuinely the best retro podcast on any platform. Neil, Dave and Duncan provide a top-notch listening experience. They provide a great summary of the retro news from the previous week, as well as deep and entertaining dives into the topics of the week. Highly recommended. Thank you very much.
Very kind. Thank you.
Yeah. And for somehow we missed this review from One Bit Head. A couple of months ago, he said, love the show and the content and listen to it every week, titled My Go-To Retro Podcast. Thank you very much. Reviews are important for us on the podcast side of things, but thank you very much for doing them.
Very kind. Thank you very much. Right, let's not slap our backs anymore, Dave. Let's move on.
No, I know. I was going to say
slightly uncomfortable, doesn't it?
Yeah. Did he listen to it? Is he talking about us? There's also been a bit of an update on the Nintendo Yuzu thing. Oh. There is a new emulator coming out called SUYU, pronounced apparently Suyu. So that's a bit of a dig. And it is based on Yuzu, but the intention is to have to miss out three key things, I think. The new project will reportedly avoid any monetization, will not provide step-by-step guides on how to play copyrighted games, and is openly against any suggestions of piracy. So these three factors worked against Yuzu in Nintendo's recent lawsuit.
And the fact that Yuzu was open source is the saving grace here, isn't it? That's why it can, have a new lease of life.
I'm not sure how much was. I'm not sure what exactly was behind the paywall that they had, but so they'll pick it up. The important thing, I think, though, is that the monetization, because Yuzu were, for all their, for all the facade they put up. Supposedly, Nintendo was on their Discord finding out that it was meant for piracy. It was being sold as piracy, and they were assisting people in piracy. So that was the problem for Yuzu. So this Suyu will apparently, hopefully, get around that. Although they do say, how is it not going to be immediately shut down, you may ask? Well, contributor and Discord moderator Sharpie told Ars Technica that the development team has consulted someone with legal experience, and the project currently exists in a legal grey area that we're trying to work our way out of. So I'm not quite sure how far along they are with that and how realistic they are from that. But I hope that we do end up with some kind of preservation for it rather than some kind of just a piracy tool. Mm.
News in brief this week, stories that we're not going to cover in depth, but you may find interesting, include one submitted by Pajaco 6502. Says the over on Games Radar, there's a story about a seemingly unremarkable eBay listing for a PlayStation 3 test console, and it turned out it had the cancelled FPS Time Splitters 4 squirreled away on it. So that's a game preserved, complete or not. I don't know what state it's in, but well worth reading about that. Thank you, Pajaco.
From Indigo Prime, there's a giant cube of motherboards being made as a kind of art thing, which looks exactly like the Borg cube from Star Trek, the one that Spock fought on the Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, if only we knew somewhere where you could get PCBs made to create that kind of thing.
I know.
Another story submitted by Dr. Local. Thank you for submitting this. It's a story about, well, emulation again, but Sony embracing emulation to bring a range of PlayStation 2 games to the PS5. This is a claim made by a company called Implicit Conversions. They state they cannot deny or confirm anything at this time, but all sources point to the fact that we're going to see a flurry of PS2 games for the PS5, which make use of emulation. Very different story to the Nintendo situation, because this is all above board, you know. Commercial rights are owned for the games that are going to be released, but emulation makes it possible to play these games on a PS5, which has a very different architecture to the old PS2.
Hmm. From Pajaco, you can play Doom on a toothbrush now.
Nothing more to say about that, Dave.
No, Doom with a toothbrush, fantastic. Anything with a microprocessor and a screen can play Doom these days, because microprocessors are so powerful. The cheapest one you'll get is as powerful as a Pentium.
There you go. You can play Doom until you're frothing at the mouth. Dr. Local has also submitted a story about the Dreamcast getting a new unofficial Star Wars game. I've had a look at this. Yes, it's Star Wars. Feels like it needs a little bit more work. It looks like something like one of those old Psygnosis FMV on rails shooters at the moment, which there were plenty of Star Wars games like that back in the day. But the Dreamcast is certainly capable of a bit more than that. So hopefully it will continue to develop, and I'll be watching that with interest, as I'm sure you will, Dave, as a Star Wars fan.
Yeah. The Mega Drive port of Metroid is now called Space Hunter. So this is from Starcade 2084. There was a Mega Drive port of Metroid in progress, but they have decided to rebrand it as Space Hunter to make it a unique game. And it's not said this is because of the specter of a litigious Nintendo, but that would make sense to me.
And finally, the Nerdy submitted this story about a new piece of electronics for the NES expansion port. It's a criminally underused port, but finally someone's found a use for it. It's a board that slots into the bottom of the NES and adds things like four-player Bluetooth controller support, wireless Super Nintendo controller support, all kind of things like that. So you can just slot it in, minimal invasion into your NES. You don't need to open it up or anything like that. And away you go. You can enjoy those advantages. And lots more stories besides over at reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. And as well as our question of the week, or will this be our question of the week, Dave? We are going to announce
so we're
going
to do
Q&A.
Patrons have asked us to do a Q&A. So we're going to do a Q&A for our patrons. We haven't decided whether it'll be released in general or what we're going to do about it. Patrons will get their chance to ask questions. So the post will be on patrons when on Patreon or Patreon. At the time you're listening to this, they'll be there for patrons to ask their questions. And once patrons have asked their questions, assuming that there's not far too many from patrons, which I don't think there will be, we'll open
enough.
It up to the general listeners to ask questions, and we will then sit down and answer these questions with complete honesty.
Yeah, and these can be questions about the show, about us, or just about opinions about different things. Just another way to give us some prompts to chat about different stories and do something extra for the patrons. So that'd be nice.
When will I be famous?
I can't answer that, Dave.
Can we take a selfie? I like being seen with you.
You just got trolled by your phone.
That wasn't my phone. It was a Google Home speaker.
Wow. What did it say? Can I take a photo with you?
Can we take a selfie? It said.
Well, obviously, it thinks you're famous now. That's amazing.
Wow. It must be some kind of Easter egg I've triggered there. Anyway,
say it again.
When will I be famous?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Wow.
I don't know. It turns out there is a Game Hall of Fame. Christoph, Why Don't You has submitted a Kotaku article talking about it and voting for the new entrant. As best as I can determine, there's already 40 games inducted since they started running in 2015, so this will be the 10th year. And for the most part, I don't think the games here don't belong. I think they all belong, but I do have some big problems with this list. So let's read out the list to you now. Wii Sports, Last of Us, Computer Space, Barbie Fashion Advisor, what? Designer, Sid Meier's Civilization, Ms. Pac-Man, Ocarina of Time, Dance Dance Revolution, Grand Theft Auto 3, The Oregon Trail, Legend of Zelda, The Sims, Sonic the Hedgehog, Space Invaders, Tetris, Super Mario Brothers, Pac-Man, World of Warcraft, Doom, Pong, Minecraft, King's Quest, Centipede, Bejeweled, Super Mario Kart, Mortal Kombat, Microsoft Solitaire, Colossal Cave, Tomb Raider, Space War, John Madden's Football, Final Fantasy VII, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, Pokemon Green and Red, StarCraft, Halo Combat Evolved, Microsoft Flight Sim, Street Fighter 2, Hadouken, Animal Crossing, and Donkey Kong. Now, Neil, can you tell me what's missing from there? Any huge, massive omissions?
You put me on the spot there. There's games that I definitely think should be there. There's games that just make me question everything. But what is missing, I would say, is 8-bit era microcomputer games. So if I'm thinking about the impact of the ZX Spectrum over here, I'm thinking Jetpack, I'm just thinking Jet Set Willy, Night Law, whole host of other Stone Cold classic games, not seeing any representation of that. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, there's not enough RPG and strategy on there, right, for a start, but more than that, it's an enormously US-centric view of games. In the UK and Europe, we had our own games and systems, and until things really unified under DOS, Windows, and 16-bit consoles. And that side of our history is nearly always forgotten. So games like the ones you mentioned, or games like Laser Squad, things like that, games that would eventually become very important, but the roots are forgotten because it didn't happen in America or Japan.
And there's some interesting things. You mentioned roots, and I think that's, you know, roots, whether it is the best version of the game or not, are really important. So you've got Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man. I would just put Pac-Man in there.
Or I'd maybe just put Ms. Pac-Man in there.
Ms. Pac-Man is the better game, but yes. Pac-Man is what created that. So I don't know. But obviously it's a list that's created by votes by the public. Yeah. So it's always going to have a bit of an interesting twist to it.
So it's not quite created by votes from the public. Public are able to vote and become one of the panel.
I see.
One member of the committee, but there's other members in there. So they're not going to have a Boaty McBoatface. For people who don't know, the British public was asked to name a vessel. I think it was an Arctic or Antarctic exploration vessel. And they voted for Boaty McBoatface as the name for it, which they didn't do, and ended up calling one of the lifeboats on it. I think they called it Boaty McBoatface rather than the actual vessel itself.
It was one of the autonomous robot subs that go alongside this that they dropped. So Boaty McBoatface exists, but it's not the main boat.
This year's submissions are Asteroids, Elite, Guitar Hero, Metroid, Myst, Neopets, Resident Evil, SimCity, Tokimeki Memorial, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, Ultima, and You Don't Know Jack. Now, there is a public vote on, which I think has been, it will now be finished by the time this is broadcast, but the final inductees will be revealed on Thursday, May the 9th. The three games that receive the most public votes will be submitted onto one ballot and will join the other top three submissions from members of the International Selection Advisory Committee. International is a word that needs to do a bit of heavy lifting there. And the public will collectively act as one member of the committee. So there's no chance of the Boaty McBoatface, as I said there, because of the committee. But I'm surprised to hear it's international, because the representation there does not seem to be international.
Dave, is Barbie fashion designer not the Boaty McBoatface of the list there? Am I missing out? Was Barbie fashion designer some epic game that I should make sure I go and play?
I wonder if it's put in there because it represented, it was a 1996 game, I think, and it represented going away from what games were in 1996, which are very male-focused, get into these guns and all the rest of it. I wonder if that's why it was in there for representation, because it did that. Maybe it's a very good game as well. I'm not sure. They will induct more than one game, but they don't say how many. And it's difficult to tell how many that's been. There's 40 in the past 9 years. So let's assume it's three games, Neil, that they induct. And I know the three games that I think belong in there. Neil, which three would you pick?
From the list that you read out, do you mean?
So it's Asteroids, Elite, Guitar Hero, Metroid, Myst, Neopets, etc.
Yeah, easy. Ultima, SimCity, Elite. Easy.
In which order?
I think, from an impact point of view, probably Elite, SimCity, Ultima. Probably that order.
You could
put them in any order, really.
Yeah,
I think
you could.
They should have been there long ago. And there's other games from the list. Robotron that should be in there. Outrun should be in there, in my opinion. Lots of games that should be in there. And then, of course, the British ones we've talked about. But obviously, this will evolve over time, and it will grow and grow. And it will be a nice talking point year on year to get people thinking about this, and to get them to come and visit their museum as well. I just looked up on their website, the strong museumofplay.org. They've got a whole page dedicated to Barbie fashion designer. I'll just read the first paragraph. In 1996, at a time when most games were marketed towards male players, Barbie fashion designer proved that game design for girls could succeed. Widely acknowledged as the first market success in games for girls. In 2 months, the game sold over 500,000 copies, outselling contemporary market leaders like Quake and Doom. A market success, the game made $120 million in the first year. So you were bang on there, Dave. And a game changer, you know, that's the sort of thing you want to see go into a museum.
Yeah. So, and I guess things like Bejeweled belong in there, even though I'm not a fan of things like Bejeweled. Millions of people play them.
Represents casual gaming, mobile gaming, all kinds of things like that. So I can see why that's in there. But yeah, Ultima, SimCity, Elite. Get them in there right now. How about you, Dave?
Well, for me, it has to be Elite. It's such an important game, and so many games have come from it. But the awards the awards been running for nearly 10 years and not already having Elite in there seems short-sighted. How could they? And the same goes for Ultima. Now, it doesn't have to be the original Ultima. It could be one of the later ones, like 6 or 7 or 5, but it doesn't have any Ultima in there. And how can they not have Ultima? How can they not have Elite? And how can they not have SimCity? So I've got the same three choices as you. SimCity, such an important game. I struggle to say this Hall of Fame is any good if they don't have those three in it already. I hope they put those three in. But even some of the other ones submitted this year, there's justification for putting those in. I mean, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater is such a well thought of game. So many people have happy memories. Metroid, Myst is such an important game as well.
Yeah, Myst. A game that I don't particularly think fondly of. I remember the excitement about it. I remember trying it. I don't think it's a great game, but I understand fully the impact it had. The right game at the right place at the right time, and the impact that it had on other games that followed it. I wonder, Dave, do you think we need to come up with our own top 40 from our worldwide audience, knowing that we've got British representation as well as other parts of the world? Should we find some kind of website at the risk of having a Boaty McBoatface go to number one? Should we try
and end up curating? Because I'm worried that we say this and it doesn't end up being great. I'm so much of
let the people speak.
I know that I could myself make a list of 40 games that would be better than theirs, although I should say in their defense, they didn't set out to make a top 40 list. They've just added them year by year from a selection committee. So it's not as if they've done it the same way that I would do it. As for us doing it, maybe, yeah. Who does the coding for that, though?
There must be a website out there where you can gather, survey people.
Yeah, okay.
We'll look into it. Expect that not to happen soon.
Yeah.
Time now for our question of the week. And last week's question was all about Japan. Ties in nicely with your dinosaurs, Dave, that you've got there. So Chris went to Japan and came back with some dinosaurs from Dave. That's what he did. But the question of the week in full was, if you went shopping in Japan, what would you bring back? We're thinking retro gear, but if you have something else in mind, let us know too. So off we go on a jet plane to Japan. We're taking the question out of contest mode, Dave.
I'll do that right this moment.
Which gives me a chance to tell people to go to reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro, where you can find our community question of the week. Contest mode is off.
So, yes, it's out. It's out.
Okay. Top answer comes from Tungsten Orchid, who says, this is not computers. He says, Kit Kat chocolates in every flavor imaginable. I'm particularly fond of the matcha flavored ones, which is Japanese green tea. This isn't really a retro themed answer, but I invoke the something else mentioned in the question. Now I'll shut up, have a break, and have a Kit Kat.
Is that sponsored? Lord Borak. Lord Borak has a brilliant answer.
One word.
Godzilla.
That's it. Go to Japan. Do you bring Godzilla back, or does Godzilla bring you back?
Well, Tungsten Orchid says, as carry-on luggage.
Christopher YDU says you just need a saddle. Okay, well, that's a good thread going on there, Godzilla. And then Computerist 1969 comes in with, finally, a sensible answer. Thank you very much, Computerist. A nice MSX machine, preferably one with MIDI or a Canon new F1 film camera. Yeah, Japan loves its MSX machines.
Ricolicious D wants a Neo Geo without a doubt.
Yeah, gaming for me comes in with a Sharp 68000. What else have we got in there? A Hello Kitty Dreamcast from Snoopanda.
Limey Tank says, I went to Akihabara years ago. I wonder if I pronounced that correctly. And there was a homeless guy under a bridge selling miscellaneous boards out of cardboard boxes for next to nothing.
Oh.
You always wondered what they were.
What's in the box?
I know, you'll never find out.
Idiot 35, a Japanese Amiga, as they and the C64 didn't sell very well over there. Well, I guess they'll have a slightly different keyboard, different packaging. That would be interesting.
Japanese Amiga, never had those two words together in my life. Yeah. I'm Googling it.
And then Manja says, I used to bring home a lot of sake to Europe and squid-based snacks. Brought home a Nintendo 64, a SNES, and a lucky bag assortment of old SNES games. Some duds and a wife. A couple of months ago, when I last visited, I randomly bought a basic module for a Famicom. But for some stupid reason, I passed and I still regret it. I'll shut up now. Well, there you go. Go to Japan. Come back with a SNES lucky bag and a wife. That's what he did. Thank you so much, everyone. That was a particularly busy question of the week. There's lots more answers besides that you can go and read in there. And it's never too late to add your answers, even if the show's gone out. You know, everyone's still getting involved in there. And our question of the week for this week, well, Dave, I've put one in about CRPGs. Let me know if you want.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay, yeah. So the question of the week is, what CRPG really lit a fire under you in the way that Ultima 6 did me? Or Dave, what would your example be?
Dungeon Master
for Dave. What game really made you get the genre, and what was it about it that hooked you in? So we're going all in on CRPGs. Make your answers as short, Godzilla, or as long as you like, and we'll look forward to reading them next week. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen and watch the show. Nice to hang out with you again this week, Dave, and all of our listeners. Head to reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro to read the stories, submit the stories, write the theme tune, sing the theme tune. Oh, I always lose it at this part of the show, Dave. It's because we've gone over the hour. I'd lose the plot at that point.
We're slightly over the hour. We're slightly under last week. So this we're making up for it this week.
Oh, Duncan, yeah. That's where it all happens. And if you really enjoy the show, head to patreon.com/thisweekinretro. That's the one.
Yeah.
And you can support me, Dave, Duncan, to keep the lights on and keep enjoying the show.
That'll do.
Do you want to do the sign off this week?
Yeah. So we'll see you next week, or you'll hear from us next week. Thank you very much for listening. I'm waving. Is Neil going to wave? Neil's waving.
He's waving.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
This Week in Retro was presented by Neil from RMC The Cave and Dave. It was produced by me, Duncan Stiles. The podcast version of the show is available through your favourite podcaster, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And the video version is available on the This Week in Retro YouTube channel.
Join our community subreddit at r/thisweekinretro to suggest and vote on the stories we cover on the show. If you watch This Week in Retro on YouTube, please give us a like and subscribe to help us reach new viewers.
If you enjoy our show and would like to support it, then please check out the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or description. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.